Today on Annenberg Radio News.
It's like MSG. It makes the movie taste like itself, but more so.
Screenwriter Josh Kagan talks about movies and music, the two things he can't live without. Good afternoon, Los Angeles, from the University of Southern California. This is Annenberg Radio News for Tuesday, November 27th, 2012. I'm Josh Wu. Many Americans eat high fructose corn syrup for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Many Americans also suffer from obesity and diabetes, but corn refiners say all sugar is created equal, or sweet and low, as the case may be. But a new study confirms what many scientists have said for years, that your body processes sugar and high fructose corn syrup in different ways. Dr. Michael Gorin is one of the lead authors of the study and the co-director of the Diabetes and Obesity Research Institute at the Keck School of Medicine here at the University of Southern California.
What we did was we looked at global data on use of high fructose corn syrup and compared countries with high versus low use of high fructose corn syrup and found that countries using high fructose corn syrup had a 20% higher prevalence of diabetes. And that was independent of any differences in obesity.
And according to Gorin, Big Corn didn't even wait for the study to get published before going on the attack.
There was a preemptive press release published by the Corn Refiners Association that was published ahead of our publication day, and they obviously were very, very critical of the study. And obviously, the food and beverage industry has a lot at stake here.
Even so, Gorin is optimistic about potential solutions. He highlighted changes in the labeling of different types of fat as proof that consumers can start thinking differently about the effect fructose and glucose have on the human body. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are dedicated to consuming, and after all that, one web-based organization looks to dedicate a day to giving. Giving Tuesday is organizing ways people can give back to their community, whether it's donating a few dollars to a local scholarship fund or teaching digital literacy. This is the time of year for giving, after all. According to the Center on Philanthropy, the average American makes 24% of their annual donations between Thanksgiving and New Year's. The Network for Good says in December 2010, the average donation was $142, as opposed to $91 for the other 11 months. The hope, of course, is that the urge to give will extend beyond this Tuesday into the rest of the year. And you can check out ways to support the growing movement by visiting www.givingtuesday.org or by searching hashtag Giving Tuesday on Twitter. And just when you think it's all over, another theory about the Kennedy assassination pops up. This time, it's a woman who claims she was Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend at the time Kennedy was shot. She's got a book out, and she's telling all. Phoebe Unterman helps us untangle the knotted tale.
Nearly 50 years after the assassination of JFK, conspiracy theories are still a hot topic. The most recent entry in the long list of theories about Kennedy's assassination is Judith Vary Baker's. She claims to have been Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend in the time leading up to the assassination in her new book, titled Lee and Me. Baker says Oswald was a Secret Service agent working to kill Fidel Castro. In a Byzantine story involving biological warfare undercover jobs at a coffee company, Baker alleges that Oswald was trying to infiltrate a ring of American communists in order to gain entry to Cuba. It was that group, she says, that actually assassinated Kennedy. Oswald was supposed to be a diversion, but they framed him as the assassin. Baker spoke this morning at the L.A. Press Club as part of her Kickstarter-funded West Coast tour.
Lee Oswald knew that he was vulnerable, but because he was vulnerable, he felt like he could pose as the other kind of guy that he did care of and did want to kill Kennedy. He knew that he'd probably be sacrificed. He did it anyway.
Baker, who also claims to have been researching a way to inject Castro with cancer, says she was in close contact with Oswald until a day or two before the assassination. She says it was hard to speak out until now, and her story is still met with opposition.
Well, I couldn't go to the FBI because of Hoover, who was like that. I couldn't go to the CIA because of David Attlee Phillips. I couldn't go to the media because they just soaked it up and put, right on the first day they said, three bullets, lone assassin, you know, assassin's been caught. So, I mean, it was all rigged right from the beginning.
But Baker says there are a lot of people who believe her story.
So people are finding out, and as they do, as I say, we're getting flowers on Lee's grave, even though they're taken away right away.
In Baker's telling, Oswald would have been found not guilty in court. But the Warren Commission and 50 years of consensus among scholars and researchers still assert that Oswald was the lone assassin. Despite this, conspiracy theories like Baker's continue to proliferate. Phoebe Unterman, Annenberg Radio News.
And now the weather. Break out the sweaters tonight. It'll be dry and partly cloudy with a low of 51. Tomorrow, expect a cool daytime high of 64, but a 50% chance of rain with showers more likely into the evening, continuing, into Thursday morning. And the cool fall weather will continue into the evening. Coming up, four military servicewomen filed a federal lawsuit today against the Department of Defense, challenging the Pentagon's longtime policy of excluding women from combat. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we speak with a lawyer involved with the case. Josh Kagan writes movies for a living, but his music is always at the center of his creative efforts. Case in point, his 2009 movie Band Slam, the story of a high school rock and roll band. Omar Shamoot sat down with Kagan to discuss film, music, and his creative process.
Josh, not only are you a screenwriter, you are a big music fan.
I put that in reverse order. I would say I am a music fan and then I am also a screenwriter.
What is the connection between the two?
In advance of this interview, I was thinking about the first time that music meant something to me in a movie. And it's two different things. There's the orchestral side of it. Of course, we've all been moved by the Star Wars theme song. I mean, our childhoods are basically colored by the music of John Williams. But then I was trying to think about the first time that a pop song in a movie evoked emotions from me that the song on its own wouldn't have been able to do and the movie on its own wouldn't have been able to do, if that makes sense. And it's the opening of Armitage's Miami Blues. It opens with Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky. It sounds like a beer commercial or a Fabulous Thunderbird song. And then the guy starts singing about Jesus. And then juxtaposed with introducing the Alec Baldwin character, who is just this absolute sociopath. It was jarring in a way. I didn't know what the movie was going to throw at me, but I knew that just from those opening chords, it was sort of building its own world. So what does music do in movies? It just enhances the director's vision when used properly. It almost draws a highlighter over the dialogue. It enhances. It's like MSG. It makes the movie taste like itself, but more so.
If you hear a song by an artist that you love, does that ever create ideas in you for movies?
I have always taken more of a cue in my writing from music than I have from movies, TV shows, and other writers. I remember having a conversation with an acquaintance at a friend's wedding, and we were talking about our creative processes, and I said just that. She was talking about, of course I read this and I read that and I play plays and see so much theater, and I was like, yeah, I really derive a lot of what I do through the music that I take in. And her response was a simple two-word, "That's stupid." Which is still one of the most aggressively moronic things anybody has ever said to me. Because, of course, Nobody gets to dictate a creative process. Everything I do in life, I do to music, regardless of whether or not music is playing.
Let's go through a day in the life of Josh A. Kagan and start with you waking up in the morning. What's going through your head?
It's always the Radiohead's The National Anthem. It's my get psyched music. It's my concentrating music. It's just, it's probably one of my favorite songs of all time. Oh, and then I think I said this on Twitter once. My brain has two modes. Thinking about listening to Ghostface Killah's Daytona 500 and then listening to Ghostface Killah's Daytona 500. Say peace to cats who rock Mac, knowledge, street astrologists, light up the mic, God, knowledge. It's pretty cut and dried. It's like very aggro music first thing in the morning to kind of get me going, and then maybe new stuff in the afternoon, and then, you know, kind of stuff that is still an auditory experience, but whether it's comedy or a podcast or Mystery Science Theater, to sort of wrap up my day.
That was screenwriter Josh Kagan speaking with reporter Omar Shamoot. A lawsuit filed today in federal court challenges the military's long-held policy excluding women from combat. Melissa Runnels talked with Ariella McDowell, a senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women Rights Project, about the changing role of women in the military.
You know, some people may ask why anyone would want to be on the front line. Why do these women want to be up there?
These four service women and thousands of women like them have volunteered for duty and volunteered for missions that will put them in harm's way because they want to do their part in the service of our country. They are motivated by wanting to do what needs to be done to accomplish the mission. And so they have volunteered to patrol with the infantrymen, even though they have to do so on an unofficial basis because officially women are barred by this policy from being assigned to those units. And sometimes that has meant that they don't get the same training as the infantrymen, but yet they go out and do the same jobs under the same sparse conditions in remote combat outposts.
How does that work, that they are unofficial doing the same job in the military?
There are various ways it is done. One plaintiff, Staff Sergeant Jennifer Hunt, was simply pulled to accompany ground combat infantry troops on missions in Afghanistan. She was simply dropped off with them by helicopter and went with them, and she was there to search the women, and if they were going to run, she would have to run as well. In other cases, ad hoc teams or other kinds of teams were put together. Sometimes they were called temporary duties. Two plaintiffs in this lawsuit led the Marine Corps Female Engagement Teams, which was a program where teams of women would patrol, again, with ground combat infantry troops alongside them, live with them. But these were women pulled from other specialty areas because officially women can't be in those infantry specialties. So these women's specialties might have been computers or logistics or any number of other things, but they were pulled for these temporary units that served, quote, in support of the infantry.
What sort of training are the women not getting that they should have if they were in these situations officially?
Absolutely. Oftentimes, units will work up together. As one of our plaintiffs was describing, the infantry units may work up together for a 6 or 7 month workup where they learn to function as a group. They learn the same codes. They learn how to communicate with one another. They learn a hierarchy. They know exactly what to do in the middle of a combat operation when a scenario happens to them. Sometimes women will be attached to those units or just simply put with those units, and they won't have necessarily had the benefit of that same integrated comprehensive workup. They may have had some combat training, but they may not be part of that unit. They may not know its operating procedures, and it's to the credit of our servicewomen that they've proven time and time again that they can learn that very quickly, even with the deck stacked against them by this policy.
And my understanding also is that pay, if whether you're in for just the 2 years or 4 years, if you have a career in the military, pay and advancement are often keyed to active duty service and frontline service. Is that true, and are they concerned about that, the plaintiffs in this case?
What's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan is that women have the opportunity to go into harm's way. They have the opportunity to live for weeks on end without a shower in a remote combat outpost. But when that is completed successfully, they don't then get the opportunity for advancement because their official career field may have nothing to do with the work that they were actually conducting in theater. The combat exclusion policy speaks in terms of direct ground combat occurring. The words are well forward on the battlefield. The reality in Iraq and Afghanistan has been that there is no well forward. There's no front line, there's no rear line. And so one of our plaintiffs received a Purple Heart for an incident that occurred when her convoy was blown up by an IED. There simply are no front and rear lines anymore.
And so how do you feel about the chances of this lawsuit succeeding in the San Francisco court?
This is the last remaining facially exclusionary barrier in the military, and I'm very optimistic that it is going to end.
That was Ariella Migdahl of the ACLU speaking with producer Melissa Runnels. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors voted today to create a sex trafficking task force. As Aaron Schrank reports, a coalition of local agencies will tackle the disturbing intersection between the sex trade and the county's foster kids.
The supervisors voted unanimously this afternoon to create a short-term task force that will meet monthly with one goal in mind, determining how and why L.A.'s foster children end up in the sex trade. L.A. County is home to more than 19,000 foster children, many who have a history of abuse and neglect. Joyce Capel is CEO at Crittenden Services for Children and Families in Southern California. She works with children who've been in the sex trade or juvenile justice system. Capel says kids like these are prime targets for pimps looking to turn a profit.
And you have the stereotype of a girl growing up without positive, healthy male role models that are seeking a replacement relationship and hence become vulnerable to either sexual perpetrators or recruiters for the sex trade.
The average age of entry into the sex trade is 12, and the average life expectancy of a child after he or she is in that world is just 7 years. It's estimated that more than 70% of children victimized by sex trafficking are foster children who've had contact with the Department of Child and Family Services. With these disturbing statistics in mind, Supervisor Mike Antonovich called on the supervisors to assemble this task force. Here's his deputy, Michelle Vega.
We want to prioritize the issue, and we also want to figure out how the county can address it, because this is something new that law enforcement is just wrapping their arms around.
The county's focus on this issue comes in the wake of the passage of Proposition 35, which, among other things, decriminalized prostitution for victimized minors. While many services like Capel's exist to help foster youth, she says more is needed.
I don't think there's ever enough services. As long as there are youth being picked up off the streets that are forced to sell themselves, obviously we need to do more.
Capel's group works to rehabilitate young people who've been trafficked. She hopes this new task force will go a step further and actually prevent children from being plucked from the foster care system into the sex trade.
And so trying to find out what those vulnerable factors are and introduce street-level, community-based programs to help deter them is our next challenge.
The task force is led by the Department of Child and Family Services and the Probation Department. They'll dig into the issue for 6 months and deliver a report and recommendations to the supervisors.
And then at that point, it'll be up to the board and the agencies involved to identify what recommendations they want to move forward with.
The Sheriff's Department, LAPD, and health officials are among the agencies involved. Aaron Schrank, Annenberg Radio News.
Now we check in with Juliana Ruiz to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Juliana.
Are you planning on spending this holiday season? We talked to a marketing professor about how consumer confidence has grown to the highest level it's been in 5 years and how it's affecting the economy just in time for the holidays. A company that's associated with the happiest place on earth may not be happy anymore. About 100 janitors and union workers rallied today in front of Walt Disney Studios, protesting the layoffs by the company and demanding fair treatment. Learn more tonight on ATVN.
And that does it for us for this Tuesday. We had help today from Emmanuel Martinez and Evan Budrovich. Melissa Reynolds is our producer, and our executive producer is Aaron Schrang. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Josh Wu. Join us again next week.